Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, October 8th. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, flattening the curve.
This means that for the first time since mid-July, the epidemic has dropped out of a growth pattern nationally.
Encouraging pandemic modeling heading into the Thanksgiving weekend. But the fourth wave is still raging in Canada's COVID hotspots. Can we look forward to a return to normal holidays? Or should Thanksgiving be another pandemic casualty? In moments, we'll ask Health Minister Patty Hajdu. Then, jobs rebound. Canada's finally back to pre-pandemic job numbers. With Canadians back to work, is it time to end pandemic aid, or at least to scale it back? We'll ask the Federation of Independent Businesses. And strategy session, yes, it's Friday. How will the federal government regulate religious exemptions to vaccine mandates? Can MPs really use parliamentary privilege to avoid getting the jab? Our Friday strategists dig in. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players.
I've had conversations with friends who are having a tougher time, you know, with, let's say, especially members of their family who are not vaccinated at all or only partially vaccinated. And I've made it clear that my advice to them, as we've actually stated here, is that, you know, such a gathering should be limited to the immediate household. If let's say, it's a family member is not vaccinated, you should politely explain your situation and your discomfort level. And if they choose not to be vaccinated, that's their choice. But there are consequences in terms of even family dynamics and others feeling safe about getting together.
It looks like the fourth wave of COVID-19 is leveling off. That's according to the latest federal modeling. And it's some positive news heading into this long weekend. More than 88% of eligible Canadians have at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. What does this mean for Canadians heading into the Thanksgiving weekend? Take a look at New Brunswick. A provincial-wide order is capping all indoor gatherings to a single household this long weekend. But why place this directive on people who are fully vaccinated? Let's ask two people on the front lines. Joining me now is infectious disease specialist Dr. Isaac Bogoch and ICU physician Dr. Quadro Karamanteg. Thank you both for taking the time to talk to us. It's nice to see you. Happy Friday, doctors. Let me start with you, Dr. Bogoch. So the federal modeling suggests the fourth wave is starting to level off. That's nice news. What needs to happen to keep that momentum? And let's keep in mind that there are 6 million eligible Canadians who are still unvaccinated.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. So wonderful to see this modeling. It's wonderful that, you know, we don't see those graphs that are shooting up to the sky as potential, you know, negative impacts. But having said that, you know, we are doing well. If you look at where we are right now at a snapshot in time as a country, obviously there's different regions that are not doing as well. Alberta, Saskatchewan, New Brunswick, for example. But, you know, if we maintain some public health measures, if we continue to wear masks, if we at least try control this virus at the level of the community, we'll probably be okay throughout the fall and winter. Of course, that means having some public health measures because, as you point out, there's about 6 million eligible individuals that are not yet vaccinated. And of course, there's even more individuals that are not yet eligible for vaccination. So there's a lot of people that can still get this infection and that can still transmit this infection. And of course, many that can still get sick and land in hospital if they get infected. So it's great that we're doing well, but that doesn't mean that it's time to lift all restrictions because we know what can happen if you do that. We've seen that play out in a couple of our provinces, unfortunately.
So let me ask you, Dr. Kayaman-Hack, does this winter pose a threat with a rise of you know, indoor gatherings? Dr. Theresa Tam suggested today that indoor gatherings should be limited to fully vaccinated people. That's okay, right?
Yeah, I think one thing that we need to celebrate is the effectiveness of the vaccine. And I think this is one thing that really incentivizes Canadians that are hesitant is your ability to get vaccinated really reduces your chance of landing in hospital, landing in ICU, and dying from COVID. So this is a messaging we need, you know, and I think when it comes into the fall months and to the winter months, yes, you know, we're at higher risk when we're gathering. indoors. In the spring, summer, we were able to have more outdoor gatherings. And so I think the necessity to encourage the people getting vaccinated, the effectiveness of the vaccine, especially going into these winter months where we could be more vulnerable, is an important piece to highlight.
So I want to ask about, you know, Thanksgiving in New Brunswick. You know, it has a provincial order in place now limiting those indoor gatherings to a single household. Now, over 80% of all eligible residents over there are fully, vaccinated. So, you know, I know that at the beginning, you know, of the vaccine rollout and so on, we're talking about 65%, 75%. So are we going to have to slow our, you know, reopening and our return to normal life because of unvaccinated Canadians? Dr. Bogosh, what's the science behind New Brunswick's decision to forbid even fully vaccinated people from getting together for Thanksgiving?
Yeah, so for starters, obviously, that's the hardest question you could possibly ask because, there's always the science.
It's not political. I'm asking you the science.
Yeah. So,
I'm glad you're taking that one.
Think about this for a second. There's science, there's policy, there's politics, and then there's melding all of them together. And here in New Brunswick, you have that policy. Listen, if you lined up 100 different experts in the field, you're probably going to get several different policies, and many people will have value judgments that are based on the science. New Brunswick decided to do this. Listen, their province is in trouble. They have a massive rise in cases. They have a healthcare system that's getting stretched. I think they're looking west to see what happened in Alberta and Saskatchewan, and they want to avoid that at all costs, as they should. And this is the step that they took. Look, you could probably rewrite this several different ways and also be correct, but this is the step that they took. I think that's something that many Canadians have come to realize, is that you can always poke holes in policy, especially policy that's made quickly in the context of a rapidly changing environment.
Okay, I don't have a lot of time left, but I want to get your take on this, Dr. Kaur-Mantak, because I think it's like, you know, it would be like a classroom, you know, eight students got an A, two students got an F, and everybody gets suspended. So I'm just wondering, where is the science?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things to consider. One is how well your hospital capacity is coping. And I think this is the worry, right? Like, to overwhelm the system when you got to limit your surgeries, limit your diagnostics, this is the fear. And so I think for me, if I'm putting that messaging out in to the folks in New Brunswick, is, yes, you know, we know it, the vaccine works. You gathering amongst vaccinated people, this is, you know, the science would support that, but we're not in a position to be, we have little wiggle room, is the way I would put it. So for this time period, public health is just asking people to sacrifice this Thanksgiving. And, you know, as Isaac said, there's a lot of factors in coming up with this policy. But for me, I think when it comes to these decisions, it's based not only on the science, but also on what's the capacity. How are you going to be able to manage the surge? And, you know, we've seen it in Alberta and where we're having literally, you know, reinforcements of Red Cross. We have people from Newfoundland coming to support them. So this is what they're trying to avoid. But I just want to reinforce to the people, because I don't want it to be fuel for those that are hesitant, that the vaccines work. And this is just that extra step to give the wiggle room for capacity.
I'm glad you gave that message. Dr. Bogosh, Dr. Kaur-Mantak, thanks for taking the time. Have a safe and happy weekend, and happy Thanksgiving to both of you.
And to you too.
Happy Thanksgiving.
So we've heard from the doctors. Now let's bring in the government on what they can actually do to stamp out the last of the fourth wave. Canada's Health Minister, Patty Haidu, joins us now. Patty Haidu, very nice to see you. Happy Friday. Thanks for being there. I really want to start with Thanksgiving, because I think that's on most people's mind. It's a nice long weekend. 80.5% of eligible people in New Brunswick are fully vaccinated, but the single household order is province-wide. What do you think about that? I mean, you know, is the minority now dictating public health measures? Is that the sound and the right thing to do?
Well, thanks, Joyce. And I did have an opportunity to hear your doctors, the doctor panel, just prior to me coming on. And I would just say that I think both doctors had really excellent points. First of all, nobody wants to see a situation where a healthcare system is imploding. That doesn't mean just COVID patients, by the way. That means really horrible conversations about what to do about people who are critically injured and there's no room in ICU. And a hospital system that's overwhelmed is one that can't support everyone, including people that aren't sick just because of COVID. But I think the second component that was really important and really highlighted is that people are feeling frustrated, those people who are vaccinated, that their lives can't resume some degree of normalcy. And I would just say this is a great opportunity for people this weekend to talk to the people in their lives that are hesitant and to find out what more they can do to convince their loved ones to accept vaccination, because right as we can see around the world, and certainly here in Canada, communities that have the highest rate of vaccinations have the lowest rate of COVID. Dr. Tam's modeling demonstrated that today, and I'm really fortunate to live in Thunder Bay, Ontario, in the Thunder Bay District Health Unit zone, where we have a 90% first dose and approaching 90% second dose vaccination rate, and we haven't had any positive cases in our district in the last number of days, and over the last number of weeks we've had one or two. So I can tell you that I feel, and I know many people in my riding feel, so much safer, and businesses feel so much more confident, and schools feel so much safer, and kids feel so much more optimistic. So this is really, it's got to be a Team Canada approach. It's a great way to protect each other.
I know, and I don't want to beleaguer the point, but how does this, I mean, you and your federal counterparts have been saying it and repeating it time and time again, go get vaccinated. But how does this encourage people to get vaccinated if they're subject to the same rules as people who are unvaccinated? Because what we're doing is, and I understand your point and the doctor's point, and they're very well taken about the ICUs and, you know, about our healthcare system, you know, in certain parts of the country being almost at a breaking point. But you're trying to encourage people to get vaccinated. I don't think that this argument helps.
Well, again, I really don't want to speak to the decision making that people have had to undergo in New Brunswick, because, of course, I don't see all of the things that they're contemplating as they're making those really difficult decisions. But I will say that they are, like Dr. Bogoch, likely working to protect their healthcare system and make sure that it doesn't get overrun, as we've seen in Western provinces. That's not good for anyone. And I would implore people that have people in their lives that have had a hard time making decisions about vaccination to help point them to places where they will be able to get free of any misinformation. First of all, that is rampant. It's rampant on social media. It's rampant in amongst people, and move towards information that is credible and that's going to help them make those decisions. And that is the hard work that we all are doing, I think, at every level of leadership, but certainly at the community level, is trying to encourage our friends and our loved ones to get vaccinated, to protect the people in our community that are relying on it. Like I said, the children and the other folks that, for whatever rare medical condition, can't get vaccinated, or even those that are, you know, more vulnerable to severe disease.
So let's talk about those children, Minister. So when will the five to 11 are waiting for this vaccine to be approved for people their age? So once it is approved, how fast do you think you can vaccinate those children?
Well, first of all, just remind your viewers that it's actually provinces and territories that do the actual vaccination. But I'm pretty confident that they'll be able to move quickly, because once we are able to approve the vaccine, of course, we have orders placed, and we'll be able to rapidly get the vaccine in its new formulation, if you will, to the provinces and territories quickly. We've tested this system now for months with Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, and we are very confident in the provinces and territories distribution system. They're actually the vaccination experts, quite frankly. They've done it for a long time prior to COVID, of course, with influenza every year and the many childhood vaccines that they deliver through schools and through health partners. So I think that we'll be able to do this project together very quickly.
So I want to talk about the vaccine mandate quickly. This will apply to workers across the public service, but it doesn't apply to MPs. Now, should MPs who want to work in Parliament be mandated to get vaccinated? You know, what about parliamentary staff or people who could be impacted by working with MPs, those MPs who are not vaccinated? Now, we know that Liberals are, NDP and Bloc Québécois MPs are all vaccinated. We don't know how many conservative MPs are vaccinated, whether most of them are, all of them are. We have no idea. What do you think about that? Would you go sit in Parliament with MPs who are not vaccinated?
Well, listen, it is my job to perform as a member of Parliament, whether that's in person or by Zoom. I will for sure represent the constituents of Thunder Bay Superior North, and I'm that much safer doing so because I'm fully vaccinated. But I do think that, to your point, Joyce, we all have a responsibility in two ways. One, as a member of Parliament, to protect each other, and to your point, anybody else in our sphere, not just staff, but by the way, the many, many stakeholders that come to Ottawa that want to meet with their members of Parliament, that have to travel as a condition of their work, that we meet with. But secondly, we need to show leadership, Joyce. This is the way forward. The way forward and out of this terrible experience that we've been having worldwide and certainly in Canada with COVID-19 is vaccination. Again, I'll point your attention to my own riding, where we see a growing confidence of people to participate in the economy, businesses who are feeling more secure about what the future holds for them, children that are desperately wanting to stay in school and learn in person. And that is a collective action that we need to take. And so I believe that elected leaders have an opportunity to show leadership in this space. And I would really urge all members of Parliament to support each other and declare that we will insist that the House of Commons is indeed a place where we can guarantee full vaccination.
But you could introduce a motion, for instance, and you would probably have the backing of the Bloc Québécois and of the NDP, forcing MPs to get vaccinated.
And Joyce,
would
listen,
you be in favor of that?
I would be in favor of anything that results. And again, I will leave this sort of procedural wranglings to the people that are working on this through the House of Commons and other, you know, other folks that are thinking through how best to do this. But yes, I'm in favor of safe workplaces. I'm in favor of places where people can come together for work purposes to meet with each other or constituents to protect our staff. You know, I am the minister, for example, that brought forward harassment and violence legislation to protect staff in political workspaces. So, of course, I believe that everybody deserves to work in a space where we are protected from coming into contact with COVID-19 and that we prevent ourselves from being unwittingly spreaders of the disease. So we have a responsibility as elected officials, especially with how our job is expected to be conducted, which is really speaking to other people.
Just quickly, Ian Stewart is exiting the Public Health Agency of Canada. He's the president. Why is he moving to the National Research Council?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Ian Stewart for the exemplary work he did on the vaccine rollout. Now, this was a temporary transition that he assumed these reins during that time where we were planning the vaccine rollout and where we were wanting to make sure that this happened well and quickly and that we supported provinces and territories. And in fact, he did a wonderful job. And he is, as you know, returning to his former role or to the National Research Council. I'll just say that we were really, really thrilled to have him and that he is a big reason why the vaccine rollout was as smooth as it was.
Patty Hajdu, Canada's health minister, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us and have yourself a nice and safe weekend.
Thank you very much, Joyce. I hope you get some time off to enjoy Thanksgiving.
And stay with us. Good news for the economy. Canada's job numbers hit pre-pandemic levels last month. So do businesses still need pandemic aid? We'll ask Dan Kelly from the Canadian Federation of Independent Businesses next. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's a major milestone for Canada's economy. Employment returns to pre-pandemic levels for the first time, with 157,000 jobs gained last month. This comes with the government under pressure to extend programs like the Canada Emergency Rent Subsidy and the Canada Emergency Wage Subsidy. They're also set to expire this month. Our next guest is one of those voices calling for that extension. Let's find out why. Joining me now is President and CEO of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, Dan Kelly. Hello, Dan Kelly. Always nice to see you. I look at the jobs. That looks pretty good.
It does. Look, there's certainly some good news that job numbers have risen. Unemployment rate has ticked down. But there's some worry behind these numbers. The number of people working their normal number of hours has certainly dropped, with many working half of their regular numbers. And of course, behind the story is a very different world between small business and big business. Large businesses seem to be back, many of them, to pre-pandemic levels. That's not the case for small firms. Only half of them have been able to bring back all of their team.
Okay, so you're calling on the federal government to extend the federal aid program. So how long do you want them extended, and for whom exactly? Because the governor of the Bank of Canada yesterday was saying, you know, you see a lot of for-hire signs. You hear a lot of businesses saying, we can't reopen as we would want to because we don't have the people. The people, our employees are not returning, are not coming back. So, you know, how long should they be extended in a context where more and more wanted jobs, wanted signs, or worker wanted signs are up there? Like, just walk on any Canadian street here in Ottawa. You just have to take a walk in my neighborhood.
Look, you're absolutely right. It's a super messy recovery. All those things are true. Employers are struggling. Right now, our data shows that only 40% of small businesses are back to normal levels of sales, even while 75% of businesses are now fully open once again. But the shortage of labor is absolutely a gripping problem right now. There are many sitting on the sidelines of the labor market, many relying on the CRB. It's now been cut to $300 a week instead of $500. But for part-time worker availability, that's really been a challenge. And I think that's where the real challenge is for public policymakers, is to try to get this absolutely right in a very messy world. That's why we've recommended that the Deputy Prime Minister extend the wage and the rent subsidy and make changes to the CRB to ensure that no Canadian is making more than they did pre-pandemic, especially if they choose to sit on the sidelines of the labor force.
Okay, so this week, Chrystia Freeland, the finance minister, said, we have spent $268 billion so far, and that was a few days ago, so it's probably $270 billion by now, on all these subsidies. Look, far be it from me to say that people don't need help, but how much more and how much longer do you think these subsidies and this help should be given to businesses?
Look, nobody wants to ditch these subsidy programs more than me. We've got to get out of having government subsidize everything that moves in Canada. That's not the right approach to build an economy. But my goodness, we cannot pull these subsidies away right now with so few businesses back to anything close to normal. Actually, I think the NDP and the Green Party have it right. Their party platforms said that the wage and rent subsidies should stick around until all of the COVID restrictions are lifted. But right now, what's happening? We're adding restrictions, not taking them away, especially with passport rules now in every province, starting to pick away and actually reduce the amount of sales as unvaccinated customers can no longer go to the restaurant, go to the bowling alley, or to the gym.
Yeah, well, I am sure you and I are going to have this conversation again, unfortunately. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Dan Kelly, Canadian Federation of Independent Business President. Have yourself a wonderful weekend and happy Thanksgiving.
To you too, Joyce. Thank you.
And coming up, the clock is ticking for federal public servants to get vaccinated or face unpaid leave. But no such deadline exists for MPs. Have unvaccinated MPs taken their parliamentary privilege too far? Our Friday panel of strategists will dig into that next. Stay with PowerPlay.
Everyone who works for the federal government, who works within the parliamentary precinct, will be required to be vaccinated. MPs, because of issues of parliamentary privilege, will have to figure out how to move forward. I know discussions are engaged with, and let's be direct about it, members of the Conservative Party of Canada who have not been unequivocal on vaccinations.
And welcome back. Parliamentary double standard. Federal public servants will be required to attest to being fully vaccinated by October 29th or face being put on unpaid administrative leave by November 15th. But that won't be the case for members of parliament. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said MPs will have to figure out how to move forward on vaccine mandates for parliamentarians due to issues, and you just heard him, of parliamentary privilege. So will vaccine mandates for MPs be the first big battle for the new parliament? And will this issue sidetrack the new government from their parliamentary priorities? Let's bring in the strategy session to weigh in. Greg McCochrane from Proof Strategies leans Liberal. Maureen Harquail is a Conservative commentator. Anne McGrath is the NDP's national director. And Greg Weston from Earnscliff Strategy Group has a nonpartisan perspective. Happy Friday, strategist. I'm always happy to see you. Maureen, let me start with you. Barring, you know, medical exemptions, which we all understand, the Liberals, the Bloc Québécois, and the NDP all require their candidates to be fully vaccinated in order to run in this election. Now, the Conservatives and the Greens had no such requirements for their slates of candidates. So the Conservatives didn't, put up a Tory MP on our panel yesterday when we talked about this issue. Are the Conservatives getting in the way of having a fully vaccinated House of Commons?
You know, Joyce, it's an interesting question, because I think one of the things that we've been seeing through this pandemic, and now, of course, as we're getting so close to reaching really great levels of vaccination, is that we're still seeing that vaccine hesitancy across Canada and with many, many Canadians who, for a variety of reasons, just can't seem to get themselves to get that vaccination. And as I said, it's for a variety of reasons. And I believe, that there's likely some MPs generally who may have some of those same feelings about the hesitancy. Our leader is vaccinated. He's been very forthcoming with that. He's had COVID, and he's a great proponent of encouraging Canadians to get vaccinated so that we can get back to our lives and get our economy moving.
Greg McCochrane, let me ask you, with the Bloc and the NDP, the Liberals would have the numbers on their side to vote, you know, for a resolution to require MPs to be fully vaccinated. Now, should they do that right after they deliver a throne speech to get us out of the way? Because there is a double standard here. The civil servants have to be vaccinated or else they lose their job, basically, but MPs won't. So should this be something, a motion that the Liberals put forward in order to get this out of the way?
Yes, I mean, it's a bit ridiculous. I've said this before. To go to an Ottawa Red Blacks game, I have to provide proof of vaccination, but a member of parliament doesn't. This is beyond ridiculous. Maureen said that the leader of the opposition is vaccinated. I should hope so, as he's had COVID. I think this is where we expect some leadership. The other thing, in politics, there's an old line. if you're explaining you're lost, try to explain your parliamentary privilege to not be vaccinated to the average Canadian. And I would also point out, Minister Haidu, in her interview with you earlier, talked about the stakeholders that come in. I would also point out that there are a number of people, there's a whole human infrastructure around Parliament Hill of nonpartisan staff. They are the translators, the people who write for Hansard, the cafeteria workers. There's some security people that kept them safe a few years ago during the shooting. You are putting them in a terrible situation. So I just think that all MPs have to show some leadership and get vaccinated.
And if, you know, I'm trying to understand, I'm trying to explain to people here this double standard. If the House passes a resolution and finds a bunch of unvaccinated MPs in contempt of Parliament, would the NDP support it, you know, or is this going to just exacerbate tensions in the House, you know, and then it's going to set the tone for the rest of the 44th Parliament?
I think the real resolution here has to be that that the Erin O'Toole in the Leader's Office has to tell their MPs that they must be doubly vaccinated and prove it. I mean, that's the way through this, I think. There is no way of explaining this. They're on the wrong side of history on this. This is, in my view, a misuse of parliamentary privilege. It's not there to give you the right to be a danger to others. And, you know, this is absolutely inexplicable. And I would bet that the Leader's Office is getting a lot of pushback from Conservatives and from their own MPs about this, because I'm sure many of them are uncomfortable, at the very least, about this situation.
Yes, because Conservative premiers are for vaccine mandates. So, Greg Weston, so, you know, will there be a compromise, and unvaccinated MPs could be allowed to work from home, or should that be a no-go, just like civil servants? Even those who work from home will have to be vaccinated, or else they will be placed on unpaid leave. So it applies to public civil servants. So why should the Conservatives be allowed to work from home? The Bloc is asking for a full in-person sitting of the House.
Well, Joyce, the way this is probably going to be resolved is through, and I hate to sound like a parliamentary geek here, but the MPs are indeed the bosses of their own house. They govern themselves. There's a lot of good democratic reasons why the government should not be able to, or the government or anybody else should be able to order them around. We value their independence. But in this case, the House is run by it's basically the Board of Internal Economy is made up of MPs and House leaders from all the parties. And the Conservatives do not hold a majority in the House. So the other parties can get together and just decide. The rules are, if you're not double vaxxed, you can watch it from home on television and you can participate through the same way, through a virtual connection. It's as simple as that. Will they do it? I think they will. It doesn't take a vote in the House. The Board of Internal Economy, just before, a week before the election, extended all of the masking rules and other safety rules for the House for another month, to the end of this month. So they can very easily just say, you know what, if you're double vaxxed, you can come into the House. If you're not, you are representing your constituents virtually. End of story. No discussion.
So, you know, the government has been saying since the beginning, we follow the science, and now, you know, there's religious exemptions. Well, you know, with all due respect to religion, it is not a science, and there's nothing scientific there. So let me ask you, Maureen, should there be a religious exemption?
Joyce, I think the one thing I think about, and just recently, Ontario's Human Rights Commission set out a release being very clear in terms of what the expectations are regarding exemptions in terms of the requirement for vaccinations. And they seemed very clear as to what those are, and there's certain very specific health reasons for that exemption. And they made no mention of religious exemptions. I would take my cue from the experts in this area. And, you know, from my perspective, the Ontario Human Rights Commission seems to have made it very clear where the religious piece stands, which is it's not part of their release.
Greg McCachran, should there be an exemption for religious, a religious exemption?
You know, I look at, you know, a pretty basic understanding of the way we work in our democracy is a separation of church and state. I think of big issues in the past, things like the decriminalization of homosexuality, a woman's right to abortion. And you look at leading figures like John Turner, who was a very devout Catholic, but was able to separate his faith as justice minister around some of those issues. And we're not talking even this century. So I do not buy that excuse, and I don't think it's worth making.
I think we have to take a break now, but we will be back. So Strats, don't go away. Greg McCachran, Maureen Harquail, Anne McGrath, and Greg Weston, stick around. And coming up, life is slowly returning back to normal on the Hill. MPs are back in town in preparation for the new parliamentary session. What do the parties have planned for this minority government? Will new battle lines be drawn? Our strategy session returns after this. Stay with Power Play.
When I had a plan for us to win the confidence of more Canadians, we fell short. The simple reason for why that happened was Mr. Trudeau used the pandemic to divide Canadians.
We ran a tough campaign. We fought hard. I'm proud of all the work that you all did. I'm proud of our newly elected MPs. And I'm proud of the campaign we ran, but we're all obviously disappointed as well.
And welcome back. Canadians got a glimpse of the party's priorities for the new minority house. This week, the Liberals unveiled their vaccine mandate for federal public servants and for domestic travel. The Bloc Québécois unveiled their shadow cabinet. The NDP and the Conservatives announced more details of their respective election campaign reviews. And the Conservative caucus voted to give itself power to oust leader Erin O'Toole. Are the leaders setting up smart minority strategies, or will the post-election blame game get the better of them? Let's bring back our panel of strategists to dig in. We have Greg McCachran from Proof Strategies, Maureen Harquail, conservative commentator, Anne McGrath, the NDP's national director, and Greg Weston from Earnscliffe Strategy Group. And he's our neutral voice, of course. And I want to start with you. The NDP held its first caucus, post-election caucus meeting. You know, first of all, how important are these meetings ahead of the new parliamentary session? And should your leader take responsibility for the disappointing outcome?
These meetings are very important. It's the first opportunity in many ways for those who were in the previous caucus before the election campaign to see each other again and to connect. And it's an opportunity to welcome the new MPs. And the new MPs are often so excited, so happy, so ready to get going. So it was very, very positive. People were very happy. What I heard from the MPs that were here this week was that they felt very proud of the national campaign. They were very proud of Jagmeet and the work that he did and the vision that he presented. Of course, they're disappointed that we didn't win more seats. We all are. But by and large, people felt like that was a campaign that was progressive, that was forward-thinking, and that actually increased our vote share.
Greg Weston, I'm curious about something the Conservatives did. So the caucus voted to give itself the power to be able to oust their leader. So, you know, you see, he's kind of a leader on notice. They all told us that we're united, but, you know, does not define unity when the caucus actually adopts something that allows them to kick the boss out anytime. They don't have to wait for the convention 2 years from now. They can do this in 3 weeks or in 4 months. What do you think about that?
Well, Joyce, this is based on this very weird piece of legislation that sits out there. And it's weird because each party votes after each election whether they want to invoke it or not. And this was a piece of legislation that was drafted by, strangely enough, a conservative, Michael Chong, back in 2015. And it was meant to bring a little more democratic control around what are otherwise very leadership-centric parties. In that, part of that is says that if you invoke it at this point and you say, okay, we are going to live by the Reform Act for this parliament, the Conservative Party, as they did, part of that says if it gives caucus the right to trigger a leadership review, not to get rid of the leader, but to trigger a party-wide leadership convention and a vote at some point, if 20% of the sitting MPs vote for it. So that's all it is. Right now, nobody's expecting that vote. By the way, this has been in place since 2015, and it's never been triggered yet. So this is, as O'Toole said, this is not a sword of Damocles hanging over my head. It is just something that is there that a year from now, it might be a whole different story. If the Tories are in the tank and O'Toole is being blamed for it, caucus has the ability to trigger some action at that point. But for the time being, it looks as though he's pretty safe.
Well, he's pretty safe now, Maureen, but, you know, it is a sword of Damocles. It is actually a perfect definition for that. So does it send a bad signal to the public that conservatives, you know, spend their first, you know, post-election caucus giving themselves the power to possibly eventually remove their leader? Not much confidence in the leader, or else they would have voted to the contrary. So what kind of signal does that send to the public in general, to the voting public, and to conservatives in particular?
Well, Joyce, I think what it does is, number one, it says that there's a piece of legislation in place. We followed it. The process has been triggered, such as it is. But that being said, I think what you saw coming out of that caucus meeting, and I've spoken to a few of the MPs and certainly some of the interviews that I've seen, is that it is a group of MPs that are committed to working together, committed to working with Aaron O'Toole, and also they want to be part of us being able to move forward. And we know that Aaron O'Toole has triggered a full review of the election, of the results, of what was done. And that review, that report that will come out, I think will really help galvanize the good things and the things we didn't do so well. But at the same time, there's a lot to build on here because, number one, our popular vote went up. We have, a caucus that is more diverse. There's more women. We've made inroads in the Maritimes. There's actually a lot of good things to build on. So to me, I see this actually as a positive step. And we will, of course, see what comes out of that report.
So, Greg McCracken, so the Liberals met yesterday to say goodbye to the defeated MPs. That's very nice. But they are going to get, there will be a cabinet, and we'll start hearing about it because the five of us, let's face it, we're a bit nerdy, and we start thinking about these things after an election, who's in, who's out, who will be here, who's going to change seat. You know, it's like something that we find pretty exciting, I guess. What are you hearing? And, you know, the Prime Minister said a cabinet in October, and we will bring back Parliament before the end of fall. That's December 21st. So shouldn't they get to work and give us what the members of cabinet, tell us who the cabinet members are, and call Parliament back?
You know, I think there was a beer ad that was, the line was, taking the time to do it right. That's what I hear a lot about when you talk to people around expectations about when we're going to see the cabinets, that they're taking their time. The three areas that, you know, obviously they're going to want strong performers in the big roles like health, because we're in a pandemic. And the Prime Minister has already indicated that Chrystia Freeland will be back as finance minister, as deputy prime minister. That sends a message to the markets, sends a message that they are working. So, you know, I can make a trick or treat joke here about how long this will take. But the three areas where I'm watching would be families around the childcare promise. I need to take away that talking point of Anne's that this has never happened. I need to see that happen. But the other two areas would be kind of in the urban area, because the Liberals in the three major cities in Canada picked up the majority of seats. And what was really important there, what promises did they focus on? And for the infrastructure and communities minister, around housing, that'll be a huge issue. And then the big one from public safety around guns. We know that wedge issue was a benefit to the Liberals. So those are the three areas besides the obvious big ones like health, infrastructure, families, public safety. Those are the three I think we should keep an eye on.
I just want to assure you, Greg, that I want you to take that talking point away from me, too.
Well, there you go. And I have a very quick question for you. Do you think the NDP will continue to sort of support the Liberal government as it was in the previous parliament and able to push its agenda?
It will be similar to the last parliament in that it will depend on what the Liberals do. When they support progressive policies, things that will help Canadians and their families, we will be there to support. When they want to do things that are not going to help, we will oppose.
And yes or no, you will oppose, and what if it triggers an election?
Well, I mean, those are the stakes in a minority parliament. I think that in the last parliament, what we saw was that when they had programs that were not good for Canadian families that we were opposed to, they went and got their support from the Conservatives.
Yeah. Well, Greg McCachran, Maureen Harquail, Anne McGrath, and Greg Weston, thank you. Thank you for being there and sharing your thoughts. Happy Thanksgiving, and have yourselves a safe weekend. And that's your Power Play Day in politics. Thank you for being here with us. We are off on Monday for Thanksgiving. Have a safe and happy holiday weekend from all of us here.